California has set the tone with a law that will allow college athletes to profit while they play. Will Florida follow? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The law is called the Fair Pay to Play Act, and it's shaken college sports nationally. We'll talk to the House Minority Leader about his plan to help Florida college athletes profit too. Also,
maybe we could imagine different ways of loving and living that aren't just like everybody else.
The Stonewall riots are an important moment in U.S. history. It raised the voices and awareness to the issues facing the LGBTQ community. The riots generated incredible artwork, and we spoke with the co-curator of an exhibit in Miami celebrating that history. And the Miami Marlins finished another season as one of the worst teams in the league. Some of the lowest attendance figures at their games. Have South Florida fans given up? All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. California Governor Gavin Newsom signed into law the Fair Pay to Play Act on Monday. The controversial law has shaken college sports to the core. It now allows college athletes the ability to make money on their name, image, or likeness. Now, college athletes currently do not get paid. They're considered amateurs, according to the National Collegiate Athletic Association, or the NCAA. Now, House Democratic Leader Keon McGee is pushing for a similar bill for the state of Florida. Representative McGee joins us now to discuss this and another bill that he's pushing for the upcoming session. Representative McGee, thank you so much for the time.
Luis, how are you? And thank you for everything.
Tell us a little bit about this bill, you know, the one that's very similar to the California bill. If it passes, what exactly do you want it to do?
Basically bring about fairness. Luis, what we're seeing is an antiquated system that's found within the NCAA. We're seeing everyone having an opportunity to participate in our capitalist society. But for some reason, the free market abilities are not afforded to these students, athletes who are actually working and playing sports and bringing the resources into the schools. But for some reason, they're not allowed to participate in the resources that they're bringing into the school.
Why is this issue important to you?
Well, number one, it's contrary to what we truly believe, right? We really believe that if the free market is okay for everyone else, it should be allowed for these individuals here. The majority of the students we're talking about, they don't have the resources at home where they can call a family member and receive financial support to get to the next level. And also, it's about equity here. Listen, at the end of the day, we're talking about female softball players, for instance. Let's be absolutely clear. Once they leave college, there is really nowhere for them to go. And to allow for a system, as the current system is, to be in place while they are there trying to educate themselves and bring in the resources to the college, it does not allow for fairness. And we simply want this to be a fair system that allows for them to participate so long as their name is their image or likeness is used for profits.
All right, it's interesting. So you bring up female softball players. Now, so much of the conversation about this bill, because this is a national debate now. This is not just Florida. There are other states also looking at this, and the NCAA has responded. We'll get to that in a moment. But really, a lot of it's been about two sports, football and men's college basketball. And that's the focus here is really you're talking about men, male players, because those are the two most popular sports in college. They get millions of viewers on television, and the sale of merchandise for those particular sports are in the millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars. You don't see that kind of attention to smaller sports like track and field, like tennis, golf, or women's sports. So how do you see this playing out so that athletes on all those levels could make some money? And let's be fair, really, the star quarterback, he's going to make a lot more money.
Right. And listen, that is a conversation, and a matter of fact, a great analysis that you brought up. That is a conversation between that individual and whomever the vendor may be who wants to participate by using this individual's name, image, or likeness. But this also transcends across other issues that we have to deal with, now. Like, okay, so many people will say, well, this is only going to really benefit the basketball and football players. But no, what about the golfers? What about the tennis players? I understand that the main draw is football and basketball, but at the same time, we cannot discriminate against a young lady out there who's on the field in a hot sun who simply wants to receive credit for her name and her likeness and her image being used by a vendor. And Lewis, you and I both know the NCAA is making billions of dollars off this. We have coaches out there who are making, you know, I read one coach is getting paid $75 million for over a 10-year span. And yet these students who, let's be absolutely clear here, they're on scholarship, but the scholarship is year to year depending upon their ability to pay, to play. And if they get injured, Lewis, where are they going to go? Where are they going to get help? How are they going to feed themselves? How are they going to help their family members? We're simply saying, listen, the fair thing and the right thing to do, if you're going to use their name, their image, and their likeness for financial gain, at least give them the opportunity to make a gain from that.
So obviously I don't have anybody from the NCAA to push back, so I'm going to have to do a little bit of that for them. But, you know, currently, you know, athletes get selected by a school, you know, given a scholarship. If they are picked, they are given that scholarship, and then there are terms of agreement with that scholarship, and the rules are set out. And the NCAA will say, look, you're students and you're amateurs. So what about that argument about amateurism?
Well, in that case, that's equated to child labor laws. When if that is the case, then if you want to use the word amateur to say that they shouldn't be entitled to benefit from their name, their image, and their likeness, then the school shouldn't be in the business of benefiting from their name, image, and likeness. Because, listen, if the shoe is going to be, if the shoe can fit one, it can fit the other. We're simply saying the system that we're currently operating in now, it's such an antiquated system that it doesn't even apply realistically to where we are today. And if you really think about it, Lewis, where else can we find where individuals are laboring on the fields, on the tracks, and not being paid for the amount of time that they're putting in and the amount of resources that their image and their name and their likeness, you know, that are bringing to the universities? Where else can you find a system like this? You're not going to find it. It's to me, it's hypocritical to sit in the classroom and be taught the very system of capitalism, and you're the student there, and you're saying, well, hold on. I hear what you're saying, you know, Mr. Professor or Madam Professor. I hear what you're saying about capitalism, and I hear what you're saying about free market. But how is it that I am excluded as a player from negotiating with a vendor who uses my name, my likeness, my image in a video game? I simply want, you know, a pack of noodles, some Kool-Aid, some extra food, and I'm not asking for millions. I'm simply asking that you give me something that would help me through the system. And I think this is an issue of fairness. How can someone in good faith look at these individuals who are playing on these fields and these tracks and say, well, I'm going to use your name, but I'm not going to pay you for
let
it.
Me,
where else is that system?
Let me go to one of the most outspoken people on this issue. Former University of Florida football player Tim Tebow now works for ESPN. And he was on a program called First Take. And he actually said this about why he thinks this is a bad idea.
I feel like I have a little credibility and knowledge about this because when I was at the University of Florida, I think my jersey was one of the top selling jerseys around the world. It was like Kobe, LeBron, and then I was right behind them, and I didn't make a dollar from it. But nor did I want to, because I knew going into college what it was all about. I knew going to Florida, my dream school, where I wanted to go, the passion for it. And if I could support my team, support my college, support my university, that's what it's all about. But now we're changing it from my university, from being an alumni where I care, which makes college football and college sports special, to then, okay, it's not about us, it's not about we, it's just about me.
Okay, so Representative McGee, how do you respond to Mr. Tebow? And this is going to fundamentally change college sports.
Well, what it fundamentally changes is an antiquated system. It simply says, listen, the free market is well and alive. Supply and demand is well and alive as it relates to when you're using someone's name and image and likeness for financial gain. I'm not saying, hey, let's pay every college student out there who participate in sports. No, that's not what we're saying. We're simply saying, listen, the system as it currently sits does not represent what the people want. And the people are simply saying, if you're going to use my name, if you're going to use my image, if you're going to use my likeness, at least allow me the opportunity to negotiate that so that I can participate in this, what we call the supply and demand market, a free market.
And you know what, shortly after the California bill was signed yesterday by the governor, the NCAA had a response. Here's part of it, quote, "Improvement needs to happen on a national level through the NCAA's rulemaking process. Unfortunately, this new law is already creating confusion for current and future student athletes. As more states consider their own specific legislation related to this topic, it is clear that a patchwork of different laws from different states will make unattainable the goal of providing a fair and level playing field," end quote. There's more to it, but just that part. You know what? Again, the argument here they're making is California now would give schools in their state an unfair advantage because athletes are going to say, wait a minute, I can make money. Now they're going to pick schools in California instead of maybe looking at other schools around the country.
I think, and listen, the reality of what we're facing is the NCAA has an opportunity to do something that it hasn't done in years. It can take this issue and own it and say, you know what? These students are right. They are correct in their analysis and saying that they want to be part of a system, a free market, whereby if their name, image, and likeness are being used, that they should too be able to have financial gain. If the NCAA sees a matter that's going to cause confusion, that's going to cause frustration, then it is driving this bus. The only thing it has to do is simply, with the stroke of a pen, simply say, if you are a student, a college athlete, and a vendor uses your name, you are entitled to negotiate your name and your image. I don't know how simple it can be for them to do it. But the question now really becomes, Lewis, what is stopping the NCAA from actually using this as an opportunity, what we call a teachable moment, to say, you know what, capitalism and free market are well and alive in this country. Let's allow for our students to participate in it. And Lewis, the final thing, listen to this part. Everyone is making money. Everyone from the commissioner all the way down to the hot dog vendor at these games. They are making money off the image, the name, and the likeness of these students. Then why are we excluding the very people who are bringing forth the labor that brings about the resources into the schools? No one has been able to give me an answer on that level to refute what I'm asking.
It is a very, very controversial topic, no doubt. Again, a national debate, one that we'll continue having. I'm talking with Florida Representative Keon McGee. He is currently pushing a couple of bills right now in the House. One, we've been talking about this idea of allowing college athletes to be able to profit financially on their name and likeness. A bill just like this passed yesterday, signed by the governor in California. I want to move over now to another bill that you're also pressing. This is very different. This one now allows inmates to reduce their sentences for good behavior. It's known as gain time. Could you please explain it to me?
It's simple. What we're seeing, Lewis, is that our correction system here in the state of Florida is broken. And we are seeing individuals now been sentenced to prison and those who've been serving their time in prison for nonviolent offenses serving 10, 15, 20 years. Now, Lewis, let's be absolutely clear. I am a former prosecutor, right, here in Miami-Dade County. And if anyone is ever going to be hard on crime and criminals, that's me. I believe I've established that credibility to talk on that level. But what I am seeing from the inside, from the different visits, is that the individuals who were in there, eventually they're getting out, especially the nonviolent ones. And to have them to sit there for 85% of their time, when in fact we, at one point, they were only serving 65% of their time, it challenges common sense as it relates to the cost, the infrastructure destruction, and also the system under attack as we're seeing it. The criminal justice system in the state of Florida needs an overhaul, but it has to begin with our prisons, because in the prison systems, the health care is going up.
Who does this benefit most, though? Tell me which prisoners could really benefit from gain time.
We're talking about the drug offenders. We're talking about individuals who are not murderers, who are not kidnappers, who have not committed these heinous crimes like capital offenses.
Nonviolent offenders.
Correct. We're talking about individuals who eventually they are coming out, Lewis, without a question. And you know, the Department of Correction will tell you this. They're coming out. Without a question. But the question is, is it cheaper for us to rehabilitate them now, to get them into our system, back into our system, where they become productive citizens, taxpaying citizens, so they can now help the system on the outside? Because there are different rates at what we're looking at, that we're paying per day to house them there. And to me, it just makes that much sense to say, listen, okay, let's try the 65% rule that we once had on the books. Let's see where that takes us. And right now we have no research that says when we did the increase from 65% to 85%, that reduced or had an effect on recidivism.
What about you? You tried this bill out last year. What was the pushback? Where were the problems?
Well, it was political, and there were people who. You know, they just did not, they thought it wasn't proper in last session. They thought maybe we needed more time to flesh it out. So there are going to be more discussions as we continuously travel across the state to speak with individuals about this. But there is an appetite for it.
And we're seeing it from how does this legislation follow what we've seen from the Trump administration through the First Step Act?
Yeah, it does. It fits directly into the analysis of what the White House pushed out through the first act. What we're seeing is, and what we're saying is simply this: if you know they're going to come out one day, and you know keeping them in is going to cost you even more to house and to keep up the health care, and also to provide for security in the sense of correctional officers, and you know you have an opportunity to rehabilitate them at a cheaper rate and to make them more productive, then why not do it?
You know what? I want to come back to this idea of recidivism that you brought up here. And really, I think maybe where a lot of the pushback has been too is you're letting inmates out early, even though we're talking about nonviolent offenders. How are we ensuring that they're best prepared to reenter back into society in a shorter period of time?
Right. Well, because we're going to require that they take up certain trainings. Like, so they're going to get their GEDs. You're not going to have what we call disciplinary acts records in the prison system. We're looking at the ones who have shown that they are willing to do what it takes to become reacclimated back into society. And that's simply what we're doing. We're not, you know, it's one thing to say to someone, listen, you're caught with some drugs on you. You're going to go to prison for 10 years, and we're just going to let you go out there without having some sort of rehabilitation courses or some sort of job training. So when you get, you won't have to, become another citizen, come back into the prison system. What we're simply saying is, let's give them an opportunity. Let's work with them while they're incarcerated. Let's give them the training for the courses that the training and the professions that they need. Let's make sure that mentally they check out. Let's make sure financially they check out, and let's just make sure that they are on the track to be great citizens.
Yeah, real quickly to finish up with this on this point though is, as you said, that there wasn't an appetite for this in the last session. So how do you approach it this time? What makes you think that it has a chance?
Well, it's always, and it's a great question, but there's always a chance. Right now, I can tell you, I have personally spoken with many of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, and they want to support this. They like the concept. I will be meeting with them again this coming session, Diane Hart and Senator Bracey also. And I believe there is an appetite with some of those who want to see second chances given. And they soon, I believe, very soon, you will hear many of them coming out to support either this bill or something similar that deals with the reduction from 85% to 65%.
He is Florida Representative Keon McGee, and we've been talking about a couple of the bills that he's pressing for this upcoming session, which starts in January. Talking about reducing inmate sentences for good behavior. Also talking about the very controversial compensation for college athletes. And again, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial and tell us what you think about either of those two, but especially with the college payment. What do you think about that? We did hear from one listener. Max Lundy tweeted us, NCAA and universities around the country are making billions annually on the backs of student athletes. The students ought to be able to share in those revenues, period. The current system is nothing less than a plantation. Again, find us on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Representative McGee, thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Lewis. You have a great day.
All right, still to come, we're going to learn about some of the amazing art that came from the Stonewall Riots. That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. In the early hours of June 28, 1969, police raided the popular gay bar, the Stonewall Inn in New York. The clash led to 6 days of protests in the streets, and in many ways, catalyzed the movement for LGBT rights. The exhibition Art After Stonewall, 1969 to 1989, celebrates the artists and activists that shifted the national conversation around what it means to be queer and open. It features pieces from the survivors of the Stonewall riots and the members of ACT OUT, who were essential in putting the AIDS crisis into the national spotlight. Jonathan Weinberg is a painter and art historian at Yale University and co-curator of the exhibition currently on display at the Patricia and Philip Frost Art Museum on FIU's campus. He spoke with Sundial producer Chris Remington about the exhibition.
Jonathan, this exhibition was 7 years in the making. How did you and your collaborators decide upon the focus and which specific artists you wanted to highlight?
I've had this long, wonderful relationship with the Columbus Museum of Art, which is the organizing museum, and the director, Nanette Macy June, came to me a long time ago, and she knew my work. They knew my work particularly on queer artists of the 20th century, really. And they said, oh, we would really like a show that was about queer artists. In my head, I had two sort of things that I really wanted to focus on. One was artists who died young. I was thinking about the terrible devastation of HIV and AIDS, mm-hmm. and I had many close friends like who are in the show, like Mark Lida, an artist that I admired enormously, like David Vernorovich, and who had succumbed to HIV. And so that was one thing that was keeping in my mind. Then there's this whole other kind of artist who I felt hadn't really gotten their due in the art world. They were often older artists, artists like Jeffrey Hendricks or Henry Hammond or Michaela Griffo, who the art world had ignored or hadn't really focused on.
And you take a really interesting approach to the exhibition, breaking it up into a number of different parts, the first one called Coming Out. I found it interesting that prior to Stonewall, coming out meant discreetly participating in LGBTQ social events, but not necessarily going public about your sexuality. How and why did that term change in the aftermath of Stonewall?
Well, I think there was a notion, and so there's so many pieces to this. There was a notion that how are you going to be political? How are you going to stand up for your rights if you don't admit to being gay, right? Mm-hmm. So that's really an important notion. And of course, if it wasn't for the civil rights movement, blacks demanding their rights, women, the feminist movement, the anti-war movement, all these different movements in the 60s, the student rebellion, both in the United States and France, this had a huge influence, I think, on the generation of Stonewall and this notion of visibility, right? And I think this parallels with the art. I've really come to understand this, even through the process of putting the works on the wall, that visibility is such a crucial theme here, that so much of the notion of the way gay art had been seen prior to the 70s and the 80s was through the lens of codes, right? You look at a work of art, and if you know it's by a homosexual, you try to find what's the code that maybe is something that someone can interpret who's a friend of the artist or knows the artist, or there's a secret message somehow.
Is that code that's like in the paintings themselves that, you know, a good artist can point out? Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, I wrote my first book and my dissertation about an artist, Morrison Hartley, in the teens and 20s, and he did a painting called Portrait of a German Officer, and there's initials, and it's an abstraction, but if you know something about the artist and were part of his circle, you would be able to decode that, right, and to some degree about how it's about this his love for this particular man who died. But so many of the works in the Art After Stonewall are about showing you things. You know, they're not about hiding things. They're about revealing things. And I think that's very important, just as so much of the, you know, in the 60s and late 50s, let's say you're taking film, there are so many movies that are in plays where the secret is somebody is gay or there's something shameful that has something to do with homosexuality. It's a big deal in Tennessee Williams plays, right? And or even in a wonderful movie like Boys in the Band, the characters are very unhappy about their homosexuality, right? But look at so many of the images in this show, including the poster and the photograph that Peter Ucher did of coming out, where people look happy, thrilled, or Keith Haring's wonderful picture of this little funny marshmallow figure sort of dancing out of the closet, right?
Yeah.
It's represented as this joyful, wonderful thing.
If you're going to talk about visibility and celebration, one of the key figures from that era would be Marsha P. Johnson that really celebrated that. Can you tell us a little bit about Marsha and sort of her role in progressing trans rights?
Oh, well, Marsha was, you know, so much in every march, every event, Marsha was a crucial figure, as was her friend Sylvia Rivera. And Marsha was literally at Stonewall, right, and at the bar. So she was part of that first act of rebellion, right? But but also, let's be clear, too, that not every group was totally sensitive to trans rights. So we have a wonderful picture of Sylvia Rivera at a famous moment in a march where she turns to the people in the march and says, look, you're alienating, you're keeping us out. You're not celebrating our participation. There were a lot of one of the things I say to people a lot about the show is that the show marvelously gives you a wonderful sense of resistance and community, because that's important and that's true. But also at any given time, a lot of people weren't speaking to each other. I think of the artists represented on the walls, you know, because there's the struggle for rights is a very tense and difficult one, and you know, and fraught. One of the courageous things about Marsha and Sylvia Rivera, Marsha Johnson, is that they stood for sex workers. They had an organization. In the day, they called it transvestites, right? That they weren't called trans people. They were proud of the term transvestite, and they had this group called STAR that was fighting for the rights of not just transvestites, but people who were sex workers. And that's, you know, even today, I think people are maybe uncomfortable with that, right? There's a wonderful image by Kathy Cade in which someone holds up a poster and says, none of us are, you know, I think I'm not saying the exact words, but the gist of it is none of us are free until all of us are free. That was a very important notion of, particularly of the gay liberation front.
Yeah, and one of the groups that really champions that as well was Queer Nation, and I liked one of my favorite pieces of the exhibition was this kissing booth, and there was photos of this kissing booth that was held in public places as a way of activism with a sign that said "Kiss a Homosexual," and I thought this was such a fascinating idea. If you could speak a little bit more to that type of activism.
Well, that's it. And I'm just thinking about the kissing booth idea, because the kissing booth starts in the early 70s, and I think that was organized for a gay group as part of a library association. They did that at a convention, right?
Wow.
And then Queer Nation, which is really starts in the early 80s, they sort of revive that idea of kissing, right? So it was something that people were already doing in the early 70s. But you know, in the 60s, one of the things that I think is really interesting is that before Stonewall, there were many events that could have been like Stonewall, where people, you know, where there was even a riot at a donut shop in Los Angeles. There were various events, but really historians have determined that the crucial decision that made Stonewall a seeming turning point was the decision a year later to make it march and to to remember Stonewall, right? Unfortunately, a lot of young people don't really know the story of Stonewall so much, but that doesn't mean that they aren't deeply involved, or, you know, or they may come into the story at a different place, I guess.
Which is really interesting, because this exhibition is on FIU's campus, so a lot of people, it's going to be young people going to the exhibition. I'm speaking with Jonathan Weinberg. He's a painter and art historian at Yale University. Weinberg co-curated the Art After Stonewall exhibition currently on display at the Patricia and Philip Frost Art Museum on FIU's campus. The exhibition will also be part of Art Basel coming up in December. So, Jonathan, I want to move over to the 80s. You talked about this a little bit earlier, the focus shifting to activism surrounding the AIDS crisis. And another piece in the exhibition that really jumped out at me was this activist newspaper entitled The New York Crimes. But when I first looked at it, it looked like a New York Times piece. And I was reading the stories with that in my mind and had to really look closer at what it was saying to realize it was a New York Crimes and activist piece. But I'm wondering, sort of looking at that and some of the other pieces in the exhibition, how much of it was just getting people's attention outside of the LGBTQ community about the crisis that was happening around them.
I think that's, you know, that's wonderful that you focus on that and notice that. I mean, it's both, you know, it's a terrible thing, the story of HIV and AIDS, and we're still in a crisis in many, many different places in the country, people who don't have access to medical care or sufficient access. And of course, if you leave the United States into the rest of the world, it's still an epidemic. So I should make that very clear. But one of the things that LGBTQ people are very, very proud of is the response of ACT UP, and then all the different kinds of artists and community groups and organizations that responded to the government's terrible lack of attention and the ignorance and all, really became a model for other medical, other diseases and how to respond to that, right? And the whole process by which ACT UP, for example, worked to get drugs approved and tested has become a kind of model for other diseases. So that's something really wonderful to be proud of. But also the whole way that a organization like Grand Fury, which is made up of several artists who purposely didn't want their names to be used, they wanted the emphasis to be on the cause, used certain kinds of graphics, images. They borrowed from other artists like Barbara Kruger, reworked their work with the idea of what's the best way to get their message across. And the most effective way. And sometimes it's subversive. You know, you want to seduce somebody to see something, right? Lucy Lippard wrote a famous essay about art and politics. She calls it the Trojan horse, right? And what you were dealing with at the newspaper is a classic Trojan horse technique, you know, because if you're too aggressive, too angry, you might turn somebody off.
Something I was curious about, this exhibition will be in three cities by the end of next year. It was first in New York, now it's in Miami, and then it's going to Columbus. And I'm curious why South Florida was chosen to host the exhibition, why it was important for it to be here with Art Basel coming up in December.
We have the wonderful work by Kreloff, who did the poster of the for the circuits parties in Miami, right? You know, yeah. Miami is one of the sort of great gay mecca places, right? Where people, party and also they've had an incredible history in terms of the civil rights story. You probably know that Dade County had was early to be to have an ordinance that was against sexual discrimination, but because of Anita Bryant, they rescinded that ordinance, right? And then there was this happened in the 70s. So that's a really interesting story that we tell in one of the vitrines, right? We allude to it, the boycott of orange juice, because Anita Bryant was the voice of orange juice, right? And so people responded by boycotting orange juice. But also the circuit parties are a really important part of queer celebrations, and also AIDS, raising money to fight the AIDS epidemic. For those people who don't know about the circuit parties, they have a color, white, red, black, And actually, Columbus is one of the first places to have a circuit party also, the Red, or maybe even where it was invented, the so-called Red Party. So that, you know, there's so many reasons why, you know, Miami is one of the ports that you could go to, I think. There used to be an old Saturday Night Live routine about the ship that goes from gay port to, I don't know, Mykonos, Miami,
we'll have to
New York,
find that.
San Francisco.
Yeah.
Right.
So let me wrap with this. When you reflect back to the 1969 Stonewall riots and you think about where we stand as a country now, are you hopeful about the future of LGBTQ rights in the United States?
Yes, I am hopeful, but at the same time, as someone who's 62 and remember how in the 70s we were fighting not to get married. I'm married to my husband, Nicholas Boschnack, for 32 years, and we were really happy to get married and proud and thrilled that that right was won. But at the same time, we worry a little bit about the idea that, of just sort of becoming like heterosexuals, I guess, or one of the reasons that I think it's so important to study the past is not just to look for people who are like you, you know, mirroring your experience, but to realize that if the past is different, the future can be different. I think that this history is so important because maybe we can imagine different ways of loving and living that aren't just like everybody else.
That was Sundial producer Chris Remington speaking with Jonathan Weinberg. Weinberg is a painter and art historian at Yale University. He's also the co-curator of the Art After Stonewall exhibition. It's currently on display at the Patricia and Philip Frost Art Museum, and you can see photos and videos of the exhibition on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, the Miami Marlins just wrapped up their season, and it could have been one for the record books, but not the records they were looking for. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The Major League Baseball postseason begins tonight with the Milwaukee Brewers taking on the Washington Nationals. Tomorrow, the Tampa Bay Rays take on the Oakland Athletics. But the baseball season here in South Florida has come to an end, with the Miami Marlins landing dead last in the National League. The team consistently ranked near the bottom in game attendance as well. Think about this. In August, the team hit a Major League Baseball season record for least attended game with just over 5,000 fans. And for a little bit of context, on that same night, the Marlins' low A affiliate, the Clinton Lumber Kings, drew just under 5,000 fans. We were barely better than a minor league team. How is the ownership trying to get fans back in the seats? We're joined now by Jordan McPherson, sports writer for the Miami Herald. He covers the Marlins. Jordan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me today.
And by the way, just to mention, he is joining us by Skype. You know, Jordan, the Marlins finished the season on Sunday, finished dead last in the National League. We kind of saw this coming. I mean, they're still under this new ownership. It's still kind of the honeymoon period. But what did we think was going to happen? Did we think it was going to be this bad this year?
In all honesty, I felt like, and I feel like this general consensus was, they were going to keep taking their lumps. It's year two of the rebuild. They've obviously are still trying to replace the talent that they lost when they traded away Giancarlo Stanton, Christian Yelich, Marcelo Ozuna, Dee Gordon, and then this past offseason, JT Realmuto. But 105 losses was a little bit higher than I thought. I had the gut feeling they were going to stay around the 96-98 losses they had last year, but they got off to a really slow start, 10-31, found a little bit of a groove in the middle of the first half of the year, and then once they got past the trade deadline, it just, the wheels started to fall off, so to speak. So overall, I feel like there was a chance that it was going to be, they were going to reach this level, but 105 losses is still tough to swallow, no matter whether you're going to rebuild or not.
It's a lot. You know what? Derek Jeter is not the majority owner. He's part of an ownership team, but tell me, really, who's running this team?
From the baseball side of it, Derek Jeter does have quite a bit of say in it. Their president of baseball operations is Michael Hill. He's been here for a while now, so he still has a lot of say. And then also they have a couple people in the scouting department. Gary Dembo, who's their VP of player development and scouting, he has a lot of say as well. He's very close with Jeter. They work together throughout Jeter's entire career.
How often do you get to talk to these guys, by the way? I want to know what kind of conversations you get to have with them.
We talked with Derek Jeter, I believe, a handful of times this year. We got him right before the start of the season. We got him about a month in, right around the draft. We got him after they announced Miguel Rojas and Don Mattingly's contract extension a couple weeks ago. And Gary Dembo, we talked with, I want to say twice this year. We got him once in January when they had a hitter's camp for a lot of their minor league prospects. And we got him at draft time.
All right. So it's interesting. This is really interesting when you think about it. You look at the situation in South Florida. You have the Miami Dolphins that are also a terrible team. And right now, the joke is that they are tanking on purpose. But, of course, they won't say that. But that they're losing because they want to get the first pick in next year's draft. And they have all these draft picks for next year. And the idea is that next year they will put together the team that we can then start, hoping that they'll start winning. So what's the philosophy for the Marlins owners? I mean, we're into year two, have year two now, this rebuild. When's the rebuild finally going to show us some results?
We should start seeing them on paper. It looks like we start seeing them reap the benefits of what they're trying to do by some point in the middle of the 2020 season. The main reason for all the trades was to replenish their minor league system, which frankly had nobody by the time that when Derek Jeter and Bruce Sherman took over the organization. At this point now, they have six of the top 100 prospects in all of Major League Baseball. Their minor league system is a consensus top five across all of the major ranking services. And a lot of the guys who they brought in through the trades either came up at the end of this year, when you look at Eason Diaz, the second baseman who they got from the Yelich trade, Sandy Alcantara, who's looking like he's going to be the opening day starter and the ace of this team, was part of that Marcelo Ozuna trade. And then next year you have Monty Harrison, also part of the Yelich trade, Sixto Sanchez, top pitcher who came out of the JT Realmuto trade,
yeah.
Nick Hunter, a pitcher who came from the D. Gordon trade. All of them should be here in 2020, as well as a couple of the guys that they got from their trade deadline, from the trade deadline July 31st.
Yeah, let me ask you about this. I mean, so that's part of the philosophy, is that they're building up their minor league system. In baseball, you have the minor league system. You hope to build guys up and then bring them up. Granted, they're not stars. Nobody knows a lot of these names you're mentioning. But let me ask you this. The other thing that the Marlins finished, very high in is low attendance. Some of the worst attendance we've had on record. Not the worst ever in history, but it's up there. Tell me what it's like at a typical game at Marlins Park.
Well, I'd say probably 60 to 70% of the games that I covered, it was barely a third full. There were the few fans that are there are diehard fans. I will give them credit without a doubt. But it's still, when you go into a ballpark and you barely see the lower bowl filled, it's tough to look at sometimes to see that you're a Major League Baseball team. You've been here. This is year 26. Granted, this is year two of the Jeter Sherman ownership group, and they're trying to bring the fans back. They're trying to regain their trust.
Right.
But when you only see 9,000 in there at a time, and you look at it as a Major League team,
And think about it. That's the stadium that holds over 35,000, I believe, right? And you only see 7 or 8. Do you ever ask the players, Jordan, what it's like for them to play in an almost empty stadium?
We asked them a few times this year, and we asked them basically a compare and contrast during the couple times when they had the bigger crowds on some special occasions. like UM night, they had 28,000. They won the walk off, and the players would basically say, "We need these type of crowds. We feed off the energy." Just from a player standpoint, early on, if you can have a crowd behind you, it gives them a little bit of an extra spark, and they know this when the crowds are barely there and when they have an almost sold out crowd. They know the difference. They know what it feels like. They've implored on fans to keep coming out, but at this point, a lot of the fans are still in that stage of wondering how far this organization is going to go, or if they're going to continue on the path that they're going with building up and bringing in players, or if when they see a player's at his peak, if he's just going to get traded away again.
Right.
Don't know what to expect at this point, just because they've been shunned so many times before.
So many years this has been happening. Again, talking with Jordan McPherson, sports writer for the Miami Herald, covers the Miami Marlins. They just wrapped up their season on Sunday. They did win. It was a 4-3 win over the Philadelphia Phillies, but they ended the season dead last in the National League, and they had some of the worst attendance numbers in the league this year. What's the future of this franchise? We'd love to hear your thoughts. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Have you given up on the Marlins? Have you just given up on the team? I think one of the challenges is that you look at teams like the Yankees, Red Sox, Cubs, Giants, Dodgers, some of the teams that have been around a long time. They have tradition. And so even if they're not good, and those teams have had their ups and downs, fans come out because there's tradition. You know, if you went to the games, it's because your dad went to the games. It's because your grandfather went to the games, maybe even your great-granddad. The Marlins are still a young team. So what is Jeter and the owners trying to do to get people to come to the games to build that tradition? What's the strategy here?
Okay, so from the physical at the ballpark, they did an entire – they basically freshened up Marlins Park from top to bottom over the offseason. They have a brand new set of concessions. They have cheaper concessions. They have a 305 menu where all the basics, hot dogs, soda, popcorn, beer, you can get between $3 and $5 to try to make prices cheap, to make price cheaper. They've lowered the price of tickets overall by about 30%. So they're trying to make a night at the ballpark more affordable from that side. And then they've also been doing a lot of work in the community. They've started up a T-ball baseball softball program for elementary school kids. And they've been basically all throughout Miami-Dade. And I believe they extended it out to Broward as well to try to get fans from the inset, from when they're just starting to get into baseball, to be interested in the Marlins from the start.
You know what, let me jump in with this. Are Florida fans holding this team to the fire over the fact that stadium, as beautiful as it is expensive and we're paying for it? That there was a big controversy about that stadium. Do you think the fans are still holding a grudge about that?
I believe a good majority of fans are, and that's also another one of the aspects that Jeter has to juggle, because He and Bruce Sherman weren't part of that deal. They weren't part of that. So they have to figure out the ways to let the fans know we're not Jeffrey Loria. We're not going to do what he did. Yes, there's a mess here, but we're trying to clean it up as best as possible. They're trying to have fans, they don't want fans to fault them for mistakes of the past, and they're trying to find the ways to remedy it. They know it's hard to bring the trust back, but in the sense, they're still trying to figure out any sort of solution to get fans to come back on board after everything that's happened over these last two decades.
Let me finish with this. I'm wondering how much the tragic death of Jose Fernandez in that boating crash 3 years ago really hurt this team, because he was so beloved. And people came out in droves to watch this guy play. He had such a vibrant personality. He was the Miami Marlins. He was Miami. I mean, how much did that really just hurt everything?
That hurt a lot. I mean, I had the honor to talk with Jose a few times. I was an intern with the Herald his last season. So I got a few chances to interact with him over that summer. And you couldn't leave a conversation with him without a smile. And if you left the conversation without a smile on your face, something was wrong. And not just from the personality standpoint, but from the player standpoint. He was going to be the face of that franchise. He was going to be the future. He was going to be the ace. He was the type of player you would have been able to build a team around. So when the accident, the tragic death did happen, it set the Marlins back even more than they already were and sort of put them in the position where they knew they would have to more or less start this team over once again.
Yeah.
Because they had so much built around him, and it made it that much tougher from both the personal fan side of it and from the baseball side of it to start to figure out how they would move forward from there.
Yeah, he was a rare player and such a fascinating character, and you had a feeling like he's the guy you could build a team around, and everything after that was so different. Jordan McPherson, again, he is the beat reporter covering the Miami Marlins for the Miami Herald, and we have some of his stories up on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Jordan, thanks so much, man. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
And here's hoping maybe next year, they'll be better. And that's our program for this Tuesday, October 1st. Sundial is produced by Chris Remington and Alejandro Martinez. Our engagement editor is Katie Leprey. Teresa Frontado is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka, and our technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. And by the way, we're listening to the Marlins team song. This is their song. Okay, coming up tomorrow on Sundial. There is no Sundial because the Miami-Dade School Board is meeting. We're back on Thursday. By the way, did you hear? We have a book club, the Sundial Book Club, and right now we are reading Dear Haiti, Love Elaine by Maika and Maritza Molit. It's our first YA novel in the book. The main character, Elaine, is tasked with a school project going to Haiti, and the project leads her there where she learns about some family secrets. It's a really interesting read. Again, our first YA novel. They are locals. We'd love for you to join. Find us on Facebook, Sundial Book Club. Ask to join. It's free. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Again, we're off tomorrow, back on Thursday. We'll talk to you then.